Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. Today, we're turning our attention back to Europe. And I say that because we've had a slew of episodes on Brussels Sprouts that have been focused on Russia and U.S.-Russia relations. But today, we're putting Europe back front and center and in focus. And in particular, we're looking at what we can expect from Germany's presidency of the Council of the EU, which it just began July 1st, on what we can expect in U.S.-Germany relations in the coming months. And to do that, we're joined by none other than German Ambassador Emily Haber. So Ambassador Haber, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I think most of our listeners are certainly familiar with your bio, but I'll just note, in addition to being ambassador to the United States since 2018, Ambassador Haber also served in several leadership roles in the German Foreign Office, including, and I always love this point, as the first woman to serve as political director and state secretary. And she's also served several diplomatic posts in Moscow. So I always enjoy our discussions, Ambassador Haber.
Thank you.
Maybe just to kind of get the ball rolling, we can start with that first piece, which is Germany's role as EU president. And I know prior to the pandemic, Berlin had drafted a very ambitious program looking at things like transitioning to a greener economy, boosting digitalization, reforming migration policy, relations with the UK and China. But post-pandemic, has anything changed? Have priorities shifted or changed at all? And maybe you can just talk to us a little bit about what Germany's priorities are for its presidency over the next 6 months.
None of the priorities you've mentioned have gone away. They all are still center stage of our presidency. But obviously, the pandemic and the economic crisis have redefined other priorities. Priority number one is the economic recovery. And along with it, we had to redesign the multi-annual financial framework. The European Council that took place a couple of days ago decided on a huge recovery program and a very large multi-annual financial framework encompassing something like 1.8 billion euros for the time to come. We have reset the way the European Union tackles the crisis, and actually I believe that with the summit, we've had international leadership in display in ways that were unthinkable during the economic recession in 2008. But beyond that, other issues will remain on the table. How to return to open borders in the European Union? How to deal with migration policies? Because migration may be at lower numbers right now, but the issue remains huge. We'll have to negotiate along with the European Parliament the implementation laws for the recovery fund and the multi-annual financial framework. We'll have, in all likelihood, an EU-China summit, which is something that has gained a new urgency given the way the pandemic has changed Chinese behavior and has made China actually act as a systemic rival, as we've seen in Hong Kong. There's Brexit on the table. So you can't really say that in the time to come, there's not much on our plate. There's a lot on our plate and we don't have any time to lose.
Yeah, there's an incredible amount. And I think this point keeps emerging in a lot of our conversations. Jim and I were talking this morning about NATO and China. And the underlying point that keeps coming up is, I think, one of urgency, that there really is an urgent need to act in so many different directions. And you put a lot on the table I think we want to dig into, but maybe I can just start very quickly with the recovery package. Mm-hmm. That certainly was one of the big headlines coming out of the meeting earlier. And it appeared that France and Germany were some of the key architects of this plan. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about what got Germany to move? Why was there, in the end, such strong support for implementing this package? And maybe just to hear your thoughts then about what it means for the potential for Europe to avoid the doom and gloom that a lot of us had at the beginning of the pandemic about, you know, a resurgence of populism, nationalism, a disintegration of the EU. You know, tell us, this is, I mean, in many ways, such a good news story, which we don't always have. So maybe just to hear how you think about what it means for Europe's ability to navigate these challenges ahead.
Yeah, but you see, in the early days of the crisis, what countries in Europe did was they were very inward looking. They would try to take care of their own, and they were looking at their own populations. Now, this was a crisis that was completely unprecedented, and it was existential. You saw the numbers of dead. You saw the hospitals in Italy, and it became pretty quickly, very, very clear that if the European Union was not going to marshal support for those hit most by the crisis, then there would be a huge, huge and long-term price to pay. And that's why Germany has thrown overboard a number of orthodoxies that have informed previous policies. What's new about the plan is that now the Commission, for the first time, will be in a position to raise money on the international markets, which actually means that European countries hit by the crisis will be supported, and they need not fear about their fiscal space or about their debts. It's the first time, and it will be a one-off, that's something we continuously repeat, it's the first time that debts are to some extent being mutualized, which means that the Commission raises the money, it hands out the money by grants and by loans to member states. Member states will have to repay at some stage as of 2028, but it will be according to their share in the general budget. So that's to some extent a mutualization of debt, and that was a huge shift of paradigm. But it was basically it came out of the sense that if we do not act in solidarity and head for more coherence in the European Union, then it might have a very divisive effect. I see the effect now is certainly quite the contrary. Of course, we had long dramas during the negotiations, but that's what usually happens among 27 states who debate about a lot of money and the conditions that come with it. In the end, we have all made compromises. We've come a long way, and I think we have displayed our capacity to get our act together and to think anew under extraordinary circumstances.
That's a great explanation, and I noticed in the recent Economist, there's a lot of glowing media report about the deal and a new future for the EU if it's able to do this, and also a new future for the, well, not a new future, but certainly a new appreciation for the French-German relationship as well, that don't count it out. You know, Merkel, Macron is here to stay, and they're going to do great things. So I think in a time of just not a lot of good news, that was good news. And so I think we're all really glad to see that. I'm going to steal one of Andrea's, one of her new favorite issues, which is China. She mentioned that. And I thought for sure she was going to take my question, but she didn't. So I will take it. And that is, it's interesting that the EU was able to come together and the leaders come together after some drama to have this common approach on the financial package. And I'm wondering, for some of the same reasons, but particularly the Chinese involvement in this, in these reasons, in terms of the veil dropping from a lot of the eyes in terms of looking at China now, do you think we'll find some similar solidarity down the road in terms of how Europe looks on China? Right now, I'm not sure there's that kind of solidarity. I think the UK made a big jump on the 5G Huawei issue a couple of days ago, and it sounded like coming out of Berlin, there might be some new thinking as well. Do you see a time where maybe the U.S. And Europe and the kind of the transatlantic community can have a consolidated view on what to do about China, or is that a long way off?
Well, there's certainly a very strong sense of urgency and awareness that if we don't, and if we're heading into different directions, and if China manages to play us off against each other, then our collective clout and our capacity to define the environment into which China's rise unfolds, well, we lose that opportunity. So it will be a major issue during our presidency. I believe that the coronavirus has exacerbated one feature of one Chinese feature, which is the systemic rival. The European Union has defied a three-pronged approach with regard to China, dealing with China as a strategic competitor, as a systemic rival, and as a partner. Now, as we've seen in Hong Kong, where actually autocratic rule is replacing rule of law, we see that the aspect of systemic rivalry has grown, has surged during the crisis, and we'll have to deal with it. And I believe in the time to come, the management of the competition with China will be an overwhelming challenge for all of us. And that means a lot of things. It means confronting China where its actions and moves are unacceptable to us, upholding international law and respect for international international agreements and upholding rule of law, but it also means engagement with China on issues where we need China, from climate change to pandemics or arms control, and which in turn means preserving and not reducing the space for politics and diplomacy. Now, there's this narrative here, very strong in the United States, that engaging China has been a monumental story of failure. And perhaps it's true that we have had overblown expectations in the merits of and the benefits of engaging with China. But I would contend that disengagement does not mean more influence. I would contend that disengagement means actually loss of influence. And what we need to do in this context is leveraging each other's clout, leveraging the interests and the capacities and the potential of as many like-minded countries as we possibly can, because we have a common cause, the common cause being rule of law and being respect for international obligations. But if we shape an alliance on that, we'll have to factor in different vantage points. Different vantage points, by that I mean we're dealing with countries that whose interests vis-a-vis China are being defined by different size, different vulnerabilities, different experiences, different history, different proximity, different geography. So shaping an alliance actually means not only defining maximalist and idealist positions and expecting others to follow, but shaping an alliance by factoring in where different countries come from. Yeah. That's true for the European Union. It's also true for the transatlantic relationship.
Do you have a sense of kind of how widely held that view is, not just at the kind of top echelons of the EU or among capitals of EU member states, but when you start thinking about public perceptions of China, do you have a sense of where kind of the and obviously it's almost impossible probably to generalize about where a European public is, but if you were to try to put your pulse in Germany, for example, on where German citizens are in thinking about the China challenge, What's your sense of where they are? Do you think they see things the same way as you've just kind of articulated and outlined, or how would you describe that public view?
Your question seems to indicate a very static answer. But you seriously believe that my answer would have been the same before Beijing moved on to Hong Kong, or before its assertive measures in the South China Sea, and before a number of very, shall we say, muscular approaches China has taken, not only in response to American actions, but obviously coming from the analysis that the COVID crisis and the economic crisis had opened space for the surge in policy. So what I want to say is there may be a lot, and there has been a lot of Pollyannaism on China in Germany, but I've seen over the past years that there was a growing awareness in Germany, certainly, that China was massively investing not only in areas where it wanted to overtake Germany as a world market leader or an important world market actor, but also moving into possibly critical infrastructures. And there was no other conclusion to take, but applying the lessons from elsewhere, China was is politically and financially investing in areas that will allow China over a longer run to encourage or even coerce behavior. So this realization has become much more profiled over the past years. And then in addition to that, I'd say that the past COVID months have added to the clarity of this analysis. So it's a moving progress. You will still hear people across Europe, by the way, who still retain Pollyannish attitudes, but overall, I think the sense of urgency is in place, that we need to get our act together, that we need to do it collectively, and that would, if we allow China to pit European countries against each other, or for that matter, against the United States, will all bear a price because we will be infinitely weaker in defending our common ground or our national ground.
Thank you. That was great. And I, as you were talking, I was thinking about how it was for you as the German ambassador here in Washington. I know there's not quite the diplomatic world there used to be in this COVID day. But still, you must talk to your fellow European ambassadors over Zoom or little coffees here and there. And when you do, are they saying similar things? I guess I'm going at the same question at another angle. Or are some of the other ambassadors cautioning and saying, wait a minute now, let's don't jump. The Americans are, the Americans are quite in a place where it's easy to follow them. Let's hold fire and let's. Or is there pretty much among the ambassadors here in Washington a kind of a collective agreement that this is kind of the way things look right now?
Well, it's always a tricky thing if you ask a German to speak for other European ambassadors. So I'll not do that. But I would assume that no other European ambassador would contradict me if I say this. There are a couple of policy differences that we have. Some of them are younger, some of them are older, and I continuously say we have a lot of experiences in dealing with it. But there's something that has changed over the past very few years that actually affects European countries, European nations, and the European Union in its entirety. And that is the mounting criticism that is leveled against the international infrastructure of international institutions, organizations, treaties, agreements, rules, etc. I'm not saying that there is not a good there is no reason to find that many of these institutions or even agreements are flawed, as most of them are compromises, while compromises are usually flawed if you measure them by the yardstick of what you originally wanted. In this, I think every single European state would argue that us being individually, either small or medium-sized countries, we need the transparency and the predictability of a framework of rules and agreements and institutions, because it gives us transparency and allows us to pursue our policy objectives. And I simply fail to see how, in a time when the international balance is changing not in our favor, when the collective clout of the West is in decline, which you can see in statistics, how we could assume that we could redo, first undo, and then redo an international system which is designed to serve our interests, given the fact that the existing system has been basically created in those decades when the West and certainly the United States was at the apex of its power. Redoing it from scratch under conditions where this balance has changed in our to our disadvantage, well, I think that would be not only very difficult, it would make European nations and all every individual, small and medium-sized nations pay a price. And I would argue, while the United States is the single most powerful country in the world, and in nearly all bilateral situations, it will always prevail because it is more powerful, well, you are not always in bilateral situations. And this general golden rule will therefore not apply in multilateral or international environments where you have to cooperate or correlate with other actors.
I mean, you're hitting on such an important point, which is the U.S. withdraw from multilateralism. And I know kind of when it comes to China, it's clear the United States hasn't necessarily done itself any favors with the way that we've been working with Europe on a number of different fronts, from the trade tensions to the U.S. approach over Huawei. I mean, there's multiple things that I think these sources of tension that may have slowed this cooperation on China. But as you've laid out, there is such fertile ground for cooperation between the both sides. And so I wonder if you could advise your American colleagues about a more effective approach to working with Europe. Are there things that the U.S. could change or do more effectively that would help build that coalition of cooperation?
When I mentioned the criticism directed against international organizations, I did not explicitly name the criticism leveled at times against the European Union and against European coherence. Now, that's not completely new, as you know. The United States have traditionally preferred to interact bilaterally with European nations or via NATO, not least because in foreign policy issues, the European Union often is very slow and cumbersome in its processes. I should also add that in economic terms, the European Union and the United States are equals, which in turn makes it preferable to the United States to seek out individual nations. But any such argument, you see, would be directed against something that is existentially important to Europeans, which is our capacity in a changing world to defend our interests and to stand our ground with regard to China, with regard to Russia, with regard to many emerging actors. So to target this capacity is, as I said, something existential. And I think this recognition and this awareness is an important point of departure. For the other issues that you've mentioned, trade issues, tariffs, Boeing, Airbus conflicts, these are not new issues. We've had differences on these issues in the past, so I don't view them as existential. These we'll have to deal with it. We'll have to deal with it that fact in a way that factors in American interests and European interests, but also in a way that factors in at the end of the day, if the overarching challenge for the West and for us all individually is the rise of China and China's China's dispute of our principles, of our way of thinking on human dignity and human choices, our way of conducting business and defending a level playing field. Well, if that's the overarching challenge, then it does not make much sense if we target one another and returning to the previous point, targeting the European Union as an organization designed to defend the collective interests of proud sovereign nations.
Well said, very diplomatic, of course, as we've grown to expect. I will maybe shift just a little bit, because we're talking about some of these external threats to liberal democracies, to the European Union, China being high on that list, Russia could be another that we might talk about. But there's also threats from within, and issues of rule of law have certainly become more salient and important for the European Union to take on. And I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about how Germany and under the German presidency plans to tackle some of these rule of law issues, in particular in Hungary and Poland, and how you are thinking about using perhaps conditionality for EU funds. I know something that was just discussed. So I don't know if you can just say a little bit about where you think that might be headed in the coming months.
Well, this story has not ended as yet. We have included in the compromise of the Brussels summit a language that relates rule of law with the multi-annual financial framework. You will have noted that there is a lot of criticism voiced by the European Parliament that one wants to place this issue more center stage. Well, I said it before, every compromise is a compromise, which means you don't get what you want 100%. You get others on board and offer them incentives for getting on board. And this is what happened last week. Now, on the rule of law mechanism, it will be the first time during our presidency that country reports will be put forward on the state of the rule of law. And I would say this, the way we deal with it and the procedures we set up or shape for dealing with these country reports will obviously be a precedent for future presidencies. So that will be a key aspect for all of us.
One, maybe just as we're kind of ticking through some of these big challenges, and I want to talk a little bit about Russia too. And we just had out of the UK the report on Russian interference in their 2019 general election. And one of the taglines there has been that Russian efforts to interfere in the British political system were widely ignored by successive governments. I guess, you know, from your perspective, is that, would you, How is the German government navigating this issue? Do you think that there's kind of clear-eyed assessment of what the risks are emanating from Russia, and how is the German government thinking about mitigating some of these election interference and other unwanted forms of influence from the Kremlin?
Well, how could we not see it? Do you remember that in 2015, the entire data system of the German Bundestag had been siphoned off?
I do remember.
And today, we've been able to attribute this to Russia. There has been the Tiergarten murder, which is now being dealt with in before a German court. We'll see how that spells out, but it belongs into the context. We've seen other forms of interference into our policy, our opinion-making processes, if you like. So I think we're pretty clear-eyed in all of that, because we've been at the receiving end of these policies. And that is one of the reasons why we have pushed for, in the European context, for new sanctions against Russia that put a price tag on the cyber attacks and the hacking attacks and other malign activities. I've heard it say here, and mostly it was mostly driven because of the Nord Stream 2, that Germany was trying to dodge critical issues with regard to Russia. I can't think, but that this is, it can't be further from the truth. The truth is that in the European framework, we've been one of the trailblazers pushing for sanctions where we felt that Russian behavior was unacceptable, from Crimea to Kerch to Salisbury, by the way, now on the cyber attacks, on the Syrian chemical attacks. We've been consistent there. And I like to say here that were it not for Germany, I don't think we would have seen the latest rounds of sanctions. We've been consistent there in saying, yeah, on some issues we'll have to engage China, we'll have to engage Russia. There, it's our geography. But we can do both, engage Russia and at the same time not look away or eclipse Russian behavior where it is detrimental to all of us and unacceptable, therefore.
Do you think that that's been a, would you characterize that as a shift in German thinking on Russia?
No.
Okay.
For the reasons of clarity.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
It's not been a shift. We've been thinking on those lines consistently.
Yeah. So one of the things we haven't talked about, and you kind of talking about Nord Stream has kind of put this back to the top of my head, is the future of U.S.-German relations. And one of the things, it's not so timely anymore, but it was the decision or the announcement that the United States would withdraw troops from Germany. How was that announcement received in Germany?
We've taken note of the announcement. We have waited for a while for explanations what that would actually amount to. We are in the course of receiving these explanations. And I would also add that we've always been a grateful host of American troops in Germany. And I personally always thought that the troops in Germany and the huge number of American servicemen and women who did a tour of service in Germany were a huge advantage that was brought to the relationship. What I was actually wondering about is, you see, up to the United States to decide its troop posture elsewhere. It's changing. It has changed over the past decades as well, certainly in Germany, and it's usually informed by strategic thinking, changing environments, changing priorities. What I found a bit difficult to understand was when I heard that there were distinctions made between good allies and bad allies and deserving and non-deserving allies, because here the observation is in place that we've been a steadfast ally and a steadfast transatlantic pillar, both in the European Union and in NATO. That it's true, we are not at 2% that we ought to reach by 2024, according to Wales' commitments, but we're not at 1%, or as I sometimes hear, below 1%. It's actually very near 1.6% right now, and our defence budget has grown over 45% since 2014. Also, American troops are not protecting Germany by being in Germany. They're protecting transatlantic the transatlantic security. They're protecting the interests of transatlantic nations. And by the way, they're also projecting American power in Stuttgart, I believe, operations for 56 or 51 nations are being coordinated. And in Wiesbaden, it is equally equally operations in over 50 states. So this is about American power projected far beyond the realm of the NATO territory. Going back to the initial point, so it's an American decision. We will wait for the definite explanations how this is going to unfold. It's completely legitimate, but I would urge you to see as well the role my country has played for transatlantic conversations, both in NATO and in the European Union. And targeting us as undeserving ally, I do wonder whether that is not risky in so far as it might shift conversations.
You know, what you've laid out is exactly correct, and I've worked with Germany since before 1990. I mean, I have seen those drawdowns, and I've seen us work out a relationship post-Cold War, and it has been a very close, very important relationship. And one of the big puzzles of many puzzles from this administration is why they seem to have this view, or at least Trump, why does he have this view about Germany? But I think I can say pretty safely that most Americans do not see it the way he does. Most, as you know, as being ambassador here, I'm sure you've traveled a little bit so far. You're, you know, having to be constrained by COVID, but I think you probably will hear over time from Americans how important that relationship is. And a lot of it does derive from U.S. forces for, you know, many decades, 300,000 in Europe, many of them in Germany. Mm-hmm. And that person-to-person relationship being built from that. I've seen it myself in the Pentagon for years. I've seen it. So, but back to questions though. You know, one of the things that's happened over the past year, I'd say year, is a very interesting debate in Berlin about German defense policy. Of course, the German role at NATO in terms of nuclear sharing, but even broader than that, and it's a debate I understand from my German colleagues that really is relatively new. In terms of what does Germany aspire for in its military in terms of Europe, in terms of NATO globally, what's the role of the German military and particularly as it is the leader in Europe in terms of defense and military things. I was wondering what you thought about that. You've been involved in that too over at least as long as I have, I think, and suddenly having this debate to the point where we're hearing talk about the French providing the nuclear umbrella for Germany if Germany pays the bill. I found that kind of thing to be really interesting. And at one time it was the fodder of think tanks, but now you're starting to hear it a little bit more authoritatively from some parliamentarians and that type of thing. What do you think about that debate in Berlin?
Well, this debate, I believe that this debate has been triggered by the changing debate on disarmament, including a nuclear disarmament. I think this was what triggered it. Well, usually, if I'm being asked that question, the subtext is, are you going to be unreliable in terms of nuclear sharing? And my answer is always very wooden. By wouldn't I mean I tell people to have a look at the coalition agreement, and in the coalition agreement of the German government, it is explicitly said that as long as nuclear deterrence is part of our collective defense strategy, Germany will remain part and parcel of the discussions on nuclear sharing. So there's no change on that. What had changed was our growing concerns about the future of disarmament, the future of arms control, and the future of nuclear non-proliferation.
You know, you have really played a central role in U.S.-German defense and security, as well as foreign policy. I mean, since forever, I've worked with Germany, you've always been the name and the go-to person. So you've seen so much in the years past. Now you're the U.S. ambassador to Germany, and did you ever think, number one, that you would ever achieve this job, which is a huge job? You're the first woman to have this job, I can't tell you the excitement in the European community here, all of us Europeanists, when we heard that you had been given the nod for this job. It was great. I mean, there was so much excitement to that, and so here you are. So just looking back on your career and now here in Washington, how does it feel to be here? Is it what you thought it would feel like as you were receiving reports from Washington from your predecessors? Or is it a different kind of feel? Obviously, it's during a pandemic, so it's a little different there. But how does it feel? You've reached this such a great summit, and you've got such an interesting perch from which to see this country that you've studied and been part of for so long.
I think anyone who would say at the outset of his or her career would say, I'll be ambassador to Washington, or for that matter, state secretary in the Foreign Office or political director, just assume he or she is stupid. Because a lot of factors play a role here. Luck, for example, or being at the right place at the right time. Working in an environment that gives you and offers you chances. So I'd say that no, I wouldn't have expected it. I feel incredibly lucky having been given the confidence and trust to take over this job. It was, in fact, the job of my dreams. And when I came here, and perhaps it's a bit unfair to my predecessors, if I say it's no more the comfort zone, the bilateral relationship isn't, that it used to be. But that's okay. Because you see, if you look at the bilateral relationship, and now I'm speaking about the American-German relationship over the past decades, I'd see a couple of very different phases. The first phase, obviously, was after the Second World War, when Germany was still coming out of a pariah role, which probably changed over time. But a shift only happened in the early 1970s, when with the Eastern European policies, Germany was, in foreign policy terms, slightly more assertive. And then came reunification, which was yet another chapter of the changing relationship. And you see, right now, and I don't think I would have predicted that 2 or 3 years ago, right now we come into the beginning of yet a new chapter of the transatlantic relationship. I don't know yet how it will spell out, but I find it easy to see that all the disagreements that we have, which have either economic or financial impacts, these disagreements will become even bigger given the degree of the pandemic and the economic and financial crisis. So we'll have to deal with these issues. They won't go away no matter what administration. So leaving the comfort zone means dealing in different ways managing disagreements, and we always could. I continuously say we have a lot of experience in that, but we have to do it in a way that takes into account that the overall environment in which we operate has changed in a way that is more threatening than it used to. So that's perhaps the new chapter.
Wow.
I maybe just add just one more question in this vein. And we've spoken so many times, but I've never had the opportunity to ask. And in part, this is useful because we have so many of our Brussels Sprouts listeners, I think, are kind of next generation leaders on both sides of the Atlantic, in the United States and also in Europe. And so the question is, what kind of advice you have to younger women who are rising up in the national security community? You've obviously been hugely successful in your field, and I just wonder what you would say to younger women who are looking to make a career in this field.
I always followed many rules, but one of the rules I followed was never to give much thought whether other people believed I could do something or not, because I felt this was their problem and not mine. And I wasn't ready to burden myself with the worries they might have had about me. I think that's pretty good advice. And the second advice is in foreign policy, in security policy, always place yourself in the shoes of the other person. Because while you might think that his or her interests are not plausible, always assume that they think they're legitimate and that therefore you have to deal with it. When I came here, I asked someone on a certain dossier, said, please tell me the flaws of our argument. And the person, I told him, don't say it now, come to me tomorrow and tell me the flaws of our argument. The next day, the person came to me and said to me, there are no flaws in our argument. And I really had to laugh, because in all arguments, you usually have flaws and you better know them. You need to know the flaws of your own argument as much as you need to know the flaws, but also the legitimacy of the arguments of the other side. I think that's, if you do that, I think you will see that you can have a voice in diplomacy.
Those are two great pieces of advice.
Very wise. That's great.
Well, I recognize we are probably longer than we had even promised you, but it was really a fantastic conversation. As always, we've covered a tremendous amount of ground, and it's always wonderful to hear from you and the way that you're thinking about these issues. And we, again, thank you for your leadership and everything that you do here in the United States. And it's always just such a privilege to be able to work with you and discuss these issues. And hopefully together we are going to be able to build toward a better, stronger relationship going forward.
Thank you so much. Better days to come.
Yeah, better days to come. Thank you, Ambassador Haber.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. And thank you for conducting the conversation the way you did.